So I feel like this episode that we are about to watch today is like the alternative factor, but good.
Okay, I need you to explain that.
Because they pick up a dude who's all like, you know, I've been chasing this other guy for like a billion years and we're opposites of each other. But it was actually good. I really liked this episode.
I honestly have no idea what episodes you are going to think are good because
Really?
I don't particularly care for this episode.
Love is a Battlefield? It was fucking awesome.
Okay, why?
Be
Just why?
why not?
I
Okay, well, let's talk about this because I thought that this it was an extremely blunt and obvious episode,
Yeah.
but in a way which I thought was very good and very necessary, considering, you know, this was 1 year after the Civil Rights Act was passed. I thought it was.
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't I thought that was 68?
No.
When was that?
1964.
Oh. Considering this was 5 years after the Civil. What happened in 68?
MLK was assassinated.
That's it! Well, that sucked.
Okay, that did suck. That was bad.
We also landed on the moon this year, so that was a thing.
Did not happen yet, but okay.
It happened like 40, 50 years ago, Eric.
Not,
It started
I
to.
mean not when this episode aired, is what I'm saying.
I thought that the episode. I like Star Trek when it's about diplomacy, when it's about the futility of violence. You have Kirk throughout this entire episode acting incredibly badass without actually fighting anybody. You have the show making about the most obvious thing about why prejudice is a bad thing and just giving these two. I thought the cruelty of the ending was marvelous, I have to say. I was not expecting the show to give these two characters as cruel of a fate as it did.
Did you expect it to end well for them?
I thought that they. I thought that they would be able to do a, you know, come to a common understanding and figuring out a thing. It was Star Trek. They've done that before.
They have, yeah. And Star Trek.
And after a while, it became clear that no, that's not where this one is going to go. And.
I mean, Star Trek is very infrequently grim. So I suppose in that way it is a singular episode. I just feel like Let That Be Your Last Battlefield is too heavy-handed and it's too obvious and it is too sledgehammery and the makeup is dumb and it's just there's no subtlety here whatsoever. And I feel like the you know, I don't want to ascribe motivations to you, but I think that a lot of why you like this episode is that we don't really get a lot of thoughtful Star Trek in the third season. If this episode
Oh,
had been in the
yeah.
first or second season, I think it would have been a low point of the season.
I'm grading all of these on a curve, and I do admit that is a very fair point. I liked it as a third season episode. It was certainly better than the past few we've seen, but
I mean,
was it is it isn't in my top 10? No.
I don't hate this episode. I don't love it. I just sort of think it's okay. You know, I don't necessarily a lot of people have a problem with the heavy-handedness of the message in this episode. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I think in general, America in 1969 probably needed a heavy-handed racial equality
I
message.
think that's a lot of it. Like, this is, in a way, a very special episode, but considering the subject of it, I'm not upset about that. You could even take it as, even take it beyond race. We are still in the Cold War at this point. We are deep in the Cold War at this point, and there is no real reason for the US and the Soviets to be hating each other, and yet they do threaten to. I would say it's more that conflict that threatens to, you know, turn the world into nuclear, you know, winter than, you know.
Well,
You know,
I.
race was definitely a conflict in America at this point, where the blacks and the whites planning on like nuclear bombing each other.
I don't necessarily know that I would say that there was no reason for the Soviet Union and America to be at odds. That's a weird thing to say. Because, of course, you know, we know now that the Red Scare was overblown, but it was definitely there and it was real. And there were communists in the country who did want to overthrow the United States government. So,
yes,
and they were, funded by the KGB. So,
and did the writers of Star Trek know that in 1969?
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't something that was like classified information.
But they've always made the thing that Star Trek has always gone into the this Cold War thing is really stupid and it's going to destroy all of us.
Well, yeah. I think there's a difference there. I think
it could be race with
the Cold War being stupid, definitely, or the Cold War being pointless is definitely something that I think you can say that without also implying that the Soviet Union and the United States do not have any legitimate grievances.
And that's a fair point.
Like, you know, I can have a legitimate grievance with someone without wanting to like kill their family.
Other thing is the US versus, you know, it was more of an ideological thing rather than a racial thing, and this is explicitly a racial thing in this episode. And yeah, yes, that's a point.
I think a lot of the Cold War stuff doesn't come in until the very end of the episode, and I do agree that the very end of the episode is well done.
It does have some really good sequences.
It does. It definitely has some really good sequences. I like the direction in this episode quite a bit. It does some interesting things, especially with the camera zooming in and out on the red alert
thing. I loved that. It's so cheesy, but it worked.
I don't necessarily think it's cheesy. I think it's, you know,
they're showing a sense of danger by quick zooming the camera in and out. Like, that's cheesy.
It's unexpected.
But yeah, it's one of those, you know exactly what they're doing. It's a stupid camera trick, but does it give it a momentary sense of panic and like intensity? Yes. So
yeah,
it's cheesy, but effective.
And the episode doesn't really have a whole lot of that. So I think using the camera to get that across is a good director's choice.
The self-destruct sequence. That was...
Well, that's really interesting because I think this is the first time that we've ever seen the self-destruct sequence in a Star Trek series. Am I right?
Yeah.
And this is something that does come up again and again. It's sort of a classic Star Trek trope. So
it's
we sort of had run out of them. You know, earlier on in the first and second seasons, I was pointing them out like almost every episode, but we haven't had that in a while. So it's nice to have one come back. It's really well done.
It's a cliche sequence. You know that they're going to go as, you know, far to, you know, they're going to let the timer run out till it says 007 and they'll stop it. Like, till, you know, but it's a very well directed version of that.
Yeah.
I love how horrible Scotty's teeth are. We noticed that for the first time.
Oh yeah, because the other interesting thing that they're doing is a lot of like these really intense close ups in the eyes and the mouth.
And everybody's reaction during that entire scene is amazing because they're all like, you know, the captain will get us through, but shit, he will go through with this if we need to.
Yeah, I think more so than any other episode so far in the third season, this is the episode that reminds us that this is a starship crew and these people are well trained.
They will never be in this Enterprise when it blows up, but they know that every day they have that possibility. And
and let's not forget that they've seen other starships get destroyed or disabled or the entire crew dying. So they definitely know that that's a possibility.
I like how the password is 000 destruct zero. I mean, it's like they left it at the default. Like, you should have changed that at some point.
Well, you know, the internet connection in space is really spotty and sometimes you don't get your password email. It's just, you know, it's not good. So they just left it.
Oh man, being the IT guy on the Enterprise.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, this episode really does dispense with a lot of setup, and they really just kind of go into it, which I like. You know, they are on a mission to decontaminate a planet. They get this shuttlecraft going after them. They, you know, bring it in. The guy gets in the ship. He's kind of like, I don't want to tell you what I'm doing. And it's kind of like, I'm withholding information, but I don't have a problem with it because Kirk calls him on it.
Yeah.
So it's a way to drive. It's not really a way to drive the plot forward. It's just a way to sort of extend the mystery of what's going on, which is fine, especially since Kirk does call him on it.
And it also does, because one of the things the episode does is make it clear that while it sucks that this guy's people are being oppressed for no reason, for something that's so stupid that the crew of the Enterprise doesn't even see the difference until it's point, like it the guy has to explicitly point out what the difference between them is, because they don't even...
Even Spock didn't notice.
Yeah, they just totally didn't click. It's so stupid, which is a very, again, a heavy-handed point, but a necessary one for the episode to make its point. But they also make it clear that in the service of his cause, he has, you know, he has killed people. He has destroyed certain things of infrastructure. He is, I mean... terrorist freedom fighter. It is about that distinction.
And well, let's not forget, I mean, this was aired at a time when the nonviolent protests of the 50s and 60s had given, I mean, this was when the 60s were becoming a much less optimistic decade.
I would say this is around when the Black Panthers are happening.
Yeah,
right?
the Black Panthers were starting at this time. Black Power was starting at this time. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. Robert Kennedy had been assassinated.
Yeah.
So this is like loss of innocence. I mean, you had JFK, of course, being assassinated a few years ago. But, of course, you have two more assassinations, especially Martin Luther King Jr., who was the spokesperson of nonviolence.
And you don't exactly get over a presidential assassination that quickly as a nation.
Yeah. And so... And at the same time, of course, we get Malcolm X, who is starting to become something in American culture.
I
actually got the sense that Loci was not based on Malcolm X, but he's definitely more in the Malcolm X vein than the Martin Luther King Jr. vein.
Well, yeah, it's one of them. Again, this show makes it clear that his cause is just, but his methods might not be. And even, you know, it doesn't really matter what the ends do not justify the means in this case, and they make it clear he's not being brought to Kirk does not wish to bring him to justice because of his underclass status or because he is siding with the cop guy,
right?
And he says several times like, I'm not choosing sides, but because he had, and all Kirk really cares about is this guy stole a shuttle. He has committed theft against the Federation. The number one, the technology that he would be able to observe from stealing a ship is very valuable. I mean, they've made it several times that a lot of people of different planets want to get in and see some of Federation technology.
Although I don't necessarily think that that's a motivation in this episode, because there's a couple things that lead me to believe that this society, the Sharons, are much more advanced than the Federation.
No, but I would say that, I mean, that would be a reason that Kirk wants to prosecute this so severely.
To set an example, you mean? Yeah,
exactly. Like, sure. I get the sense that stealing any Federation property is taken extremely seriously. Obviously, he only stole the ship literally to get away. It was a getaway car for him.
Right.
But they have to treat everybody as if they're, spies in a way.
Yeah, and that's fair.
I thought that was interesting, and I figure having him be so evasive and shady at the beginning kind of makes him less the show does very carefully not let you sympathize with one or the other. The commissioner is very helpful to Kirk at first, and he is very, here's the situation, here's who I am, when he initially says, I'm claiming my prisoner, and Kirk says, this is my ship. And it seems genuine, saying, that's maybe a stronger word than I meant, yes, this is your ship. Like he is making it clear, like, I'm not trying to overstep you. Like, I'm just exuberant about this, you know, and he is very bloodthirsty at the end. But
I think it's interesting because, the racial elements of the episode are very heavy handed and the message is heavy handed, but I don't necessarily think that Loci and the other guy, I don't remember his name, I have it written down, but...
Beale, I want to say?
Yeah, Beale, who was played by the guy who played the Riddler in the Batman 60s show, which is probably why you sort of recognized him.
Yes! Why it did have a very Batman feel to it.
Yeah, probably. And even the costumes they use, which do not hide the fact that both men were, endowed.
It was a bulge. Now, by the way, I do have a question. Is it like black and white all the way down?
I would assume so. That's why I assume that the actors were wearing gloves in the episode, because they didn't want to take the time to use their hands. I don't know.
I mean, they could wear one white glove, one black glove.
Yeah, that would look a little weird, though. But I like the fact
that that would make the episode look weird. That, it was fine before that, but they figure, you know, that's a little much.
You know.
We want to be tasteful.
That the episode does go out of its way to paint both Beale and Lokai as unsympathetic and sympathetic.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, Beale could just be a scenery-chewing villain, but he does allow the Enterprise to complete its humanitarian mission.
After Kirk essentially threatens to blow up the entire ship, he doesn't exactly do it willingly. He very grudgingly does it, and then immediately once it does it, he hijacks the ship again.
But let's not forget, he hijacks the ship, and not only does he hijack the ship again, he does disable the self-destruct sequence. So he does let the ship complete its mission. I think he could have just said, okay, don't destroy the ship, let's go. And then 5 minutes later, he could have now known that they had a self-destruct and destroyed the self-destruct. And, you know, the planet would have been screwed and they would have gone to Charon. So I don't think he's portrayed as necessarily like, he's definitely the villain of the episode, but I don't think that he's supposed to be sort of this cartoonish scene chewing villain.
And that is a point I will agree with. And yeah, again,
and I don't think that Lokai is that sympathetic either.
No. And again, this show makes it clear that, you know, Beale is prosecuting somebody who has committed crimes, but at the same time, you know, those crimes were committed out of a desire to throw off an oppression. You know, Lokai has, you know, a noble cause, and his people are an underclass for no reason whatsoever. But at the same time, he has used methods which have hurt people who are not direct, you know, who may not have had a direct role in that oppression. So it makes the episode, ironically, it's not as black and white of an episode as it purports to be. It paints both of them as extremely, again, you can't say either is bad or good. They just have been so consumed by this stupid hatred for each other that, you know, obviously it's a metonym for what happens to the world is, you know, this literally every single person on the planet dies because of this and is consumed by this.
Yeah.
And they, the last two members of their species, cannot get over their hatred enough. So even at the very end, they are, and again, this is why I thought the parallel to Alternative Factor, because the two guys are spent an eternal struggle with each other. At the end of this episode, Lokai and Beale are more or less in a symbolic eternal struggle together. They never do resolve it. They, you know, it's only their own, it's implied they're immortal. You'll think, I picture they will always be fighting.
Yeah, or they'll kill each other. And that's
what the thing is. Their inability to let go is destroying them. And
again,
I thought that was the show does not even necessarily give them the possibility of redemption and holding on to this hate. They need to so completely get rid of it, which is something they are almost incapable of doing.
Yeah.
And maybe it is just because Star Trek is rarely so grim that it struck me, but I felt the grimness made sense here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the end of the episode needs to be that grim. I don't think that you can get away without that. And I do appreciate the fact that, you know, because there's no evidence presented of any of this, right? So you sort of just have Lokai going, look, we're oppressed. They don't like us. He doesn't ever really say why. He thinks it's self-evident, so he doesn't need to explain it. And the interesting thing is Beale doesn't explain it either, but then he's like, isn't it obvious? Isn't it obvious? And I like that because it shows a willingness to understand that people in positions of power that are subjugating someone or a group of people for purely, you know, stupid reasons like skin color, don't necessarily hide their hatred. And they kind of, because they assume that everyone thinks the way they do. And so if you don't live in a society which doesn't kind of tamp that kind of thing down, you're not going to. I mean, I think this would have been a very much it would have been a very different episode if Beal had realized that he maybe needed to make a story up about what Lokai was instead of immediately jumping to, hey, he looks different from me, therefore yeah. he should be killed.
I mean, that's almost something like, you know, we risk the wrath of Godwin, but the Nazis had almost scientific things, you know, about, racial inferiority was scientifically based. They may have something like that in this society, where he feels like that's a fact of nature that everybody knows in a way.
Yeah, I mean, this is very much more of a morality play than anything else. We don't get a sense of what the Sharonian civilization was supposed to be like, but it doesn't really matter.
I would assume it's very. I would assume they're similar to the, maybe not particularly in 1969, but maybe in. You know, just post-Civil War era, you know, the status of blacks at that point, maybe that's where the society is, something along that line.
Yeah.
I assumed well, it was something like that, where it's not an explicit slavery situation, but they
well,
are...
Well, no, they do say that.
But at this point, they had said that slavery was freed, and it's that's one of the things. The Lokai says, you know, we should be equal now, and Beal is saying, well, that it takes time for that. And, you know, I know one of the issues with, you know, freed slaves after the Civil War was you have people who have not been given an education. You have people who have not had property. You have people who do not have a leg up. And yes, there need to be things in place for that. So that is a legitimate point. You need to have society working towards integrating this underclass into... which does take a while. Lokai's point is that should have happened by now, certainly.
Well, let's tease that out, because I think that's one of the reasons why this episode is okay, but you know, I think it's a little it's heavy-handed. And I think that's one of the reasons why, because you do have that sequence in the middle of the episode where Beal is basically giving the racist explanation for the Southern American policy against blacks in 1950. Because you say, oh, well, after the Civil War, blacks had this and that and the other thing. They had it in 1950. I mean, this was something that had been going on for 100 years. And so what Beal was saying in that scene was pretty much the status of blacks as soon, you know, as recently as 10 years ago from the airing of this episode.
And I agree that I don't think the show agrees that I think the takeaway from that is, while at some point that may have been true, Beal's people did not do their proper thing. Like, if they had said, okay, shit, slavery's over, we're going to fix this, that would have been one thing. And Lokai's point is, yeah, you had a few years where it could have been difficult, and that was fine, but you didn't make progress fast enough. And I think
I think that's where the episode falls down in the analogy, because the reason why blacks in the South did not get full equality wasn't because they didn't wait long enough. It was because there was a systematic legal oppression of them in the Southern states that the federal government basically threw up its hands and didn't do anything about for 100 years.
Which is what Lokai is saying. I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah, I mean, not really.
I mean, again, this is not and I don't think it's intended to be a point A, point B, point C comparison.
Well, I think it is. And that's why I think the episode is too heavy-handed and also falls on its face a little bit, because it's heavy-handed, but it's heavy-handed in sort of a superficial way.
I got the sense it was more about racism written by Americans rather than about American racism, if you know what I mean.
Oh, no, I definitely think it's supposed to be about American racism. Yeah. I don't see that there's any other reading for it.
But I think that's more because that was the point of view of the writers, and because when you think of, you know, when America has a very dramatic and recent and very well studied and very obvious racial divide, and has a very obvious fairly recent major war dealing with racist issues. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's just more dramatic. And
I think you could have made that argument if this had been an episode of any other series of Star Trek. But coming in 1969,
and that's fair.
I think there's no other way to read it than this is supposed to be an explicit analogy of the civil rights struggle of the 50s and 60s in America.
I did like – what I did think was interesting is at one point, and I think it's actually Chekhov who mentions it, that something like, yes, there was prejudice, but that was a 20th century thing. And like – and I just always remember how the eugenics war was at the end of the 20th century in this history, and that – the show has always made clear is what effectively ended the concept of prejudice as far as within humanity,
yeah.
Because essentially they saw how to it's just as, you know, the Holocaust for many people made anti-Semitism completely unsustainable because that was the logical end result of this. The eugenics war was the logical end result of racism in the Star Trek universe. And I think that's another I just always remember that point. And like I said, I would love to see a Star Trek prequel series in that time. I think it would be fucked up and terrifying.
Yeah, I don't know that you could necessarily sustain a television show through a period like that. Yeah, people don't do miniseries anymore, which is probably a bad thing. I mean, yeah, you're right. Like a 4 or 6 hour miniseries, maybe it would be interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I always think of something like The Walking Dead, which you haven't seen, but the Walking Dead is a show where I think that's the closest analogy to something that you're trying to get at, where it's sort of this horrifying, never ending terror, and doesn't work well as a TV show because it takes a lot of skill to keep that sort of tension up episode through season.
Yeah.
And also it's not that fun to watch.
Oh no. And that's fair. And you know, anyway, this is just, I think it's a mark of this episode that we're talking about our dream Star Trek series again.
Yeah, that's true.
I know we've had a lot of that as a problem in season three, where we talk about
other things. I think the last thing probably that we can say about the episode is I also like the fact that they are both Beale and Lokai are portrayed as unsympathetic because they're also racist, but
yeah.
they're racist against what they call monocolors. So
yeah.
I kind of liked that as well.
That's true.
You know, I just think it's just because you're being discriminated against doesn't mean that you can also not be discriminated, not be discriminatory. And I think, again, I think I think that this episode is a lot more influenced by and is a direct response to the outgrowth of Black Power and the Malcolm X movement and all that sort of stuff in the late 60s out of the civil rights movement, especially after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. I think there's a lot of stuff there. I think it would have been a better episode if it had not been so heavy handed, but it's not.
I think it needed to be heavy handed. I think it would not have been.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I wonder, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, activist art. Who's going to watch it? Who's going to see it? Are you only really talking to the people who agree with you? You know, were people watching this episode in Mississippi and going, oh yeah, you know what? We're fuckheads. Like, I don't think so.
No. And that is fair. At the same time, I don't think there's a problem with validating that kind of philosophy.
True. Yeah.
I think, you know, this is,
there's a reason why, you know, every major city in the world has a Holocaust museum.
Yeah, exactly. This is Star Trek reaffirming one of its values is anti-racism. And I don't think that, again, especially in the United States in 1969, I don't think you could be that subtle or say that, you know, too few times.
Yeah, that's true.
Mostly that.
All right. Well, I will give this I'll give this 6. I think it's 6 triple episode.
It's an 8 triple episode. I really liked it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to The Mark of Gideon.
So this episode reminds me of something that happened to me a couple years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
What was that?
I was on the PATH train at night.
Okay. That's it?
Well, I mean, you know, it's basically a room where I'm like being sardined against a billion people.
Okay. All right.
That's, you know, so I was very happy to see this element of my life reflected in this episode of Star Trek.
That is a good point. I thought that thing in the episode was quite ridiculous.
I thought, no, this episode...
I mean, it was just kind of like, you didn't really know where the episode was going. And then at a certain point, they're down on the planet and Kirk looks out a window and it's just a bunch of bald-headed people with green lights bumping into each other.
They weren't bald-headed. They like, all why? Had like the, they all had like mask, like hoodie mask thingies on. This planet makes no sense. So
the planet in the Mark of Gideon is supposed to be so overpopulated that everybody just sort of wanders around in a daze.
Yeah, because
if your planet is that overpopulated, then why don't you just like stop moving?
Well, here's the thing. So basically in this episode, they're saying, okay, they their planet, whatever, has no like germs in it. So their bodies evolve to a degree where they never die, or it takes them so many thousands of years to die that effectively, you know, it doesn't matter.
Correct.
And because every time they reproduce, the population is not dying, and the, you know, so number one, I guess it is kind of hard to not have sex when all you're doing is, you know, staying in a room and, you know, bumping up against each other. Like, I think pregnancy might happen accidentally in this world. Number two, so what they want to do instead.
So wait, so do they have rape on this planet?
I don't know. It's hard to say that, but, you know, they do say that they would die for a piece of alone time or kill for it. So that makes me think they might.
Okay. Yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, but just structurally, there are so many problems with this episode. The planet is so overpopulated, and yet they find the room to build an exact replica of a starship.
Well, there's that.
That, and why do they do that?
Here's my question. So you have... So now at some point, I don't know if it's been done at this point, but generally it's established that the development of warp is the time when the Federation can contact another planet. So because the Federation has been in touch with this planet...
Well, that hasn't been established in the original series.
Okay, but can we say that that might be the case? Does this planet have space-faring technology or not?
I have no idea.
Because... if the Federation is in touch with them, what they do is they make this bullshit thing about, you know, oh, we've got this great, you know, planet, but we'll only let Captain Kirk because Captain Kirk has this rare disease, which is the only thing that can kill the Gideons or whatever.
It's not even that he has a rare disease. It's that he had the rare disease.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, I guess, was cured and still has antibodies for it.
Yeah, I was like, going to say, I get the sense it's one of
like
those...
kind of like the chicken pox.
Yeah, where the virus is in your bloodstream but dormant or, you know, sterile or whatever.
Sure.
But it can affect somebody else. Yeah. Instead of saying, look, we're an overcrowded planet and this is a universe that has space travel, that has tons of empty planets that could be colonized, that has... You know, there are so many options for this species to spread out a bit. We've seen several occasions in which the Federation has offered a planet to a race that needs it. I mean, they can colonize. I'm sure there are entire solar systems that they would be totally okay to move into. Why is that not mentioned at all?
Maybe the rent's too high?
It could be.
I that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well,
I can kind of think of a few uses that the Federation could, if the Federation wants payment, could use for a race of immortals. I think they might be able to make some deals here.
Well, okay. Here's a little piece of trivia that I know that you will love. Not as much as some other pieces of trivia, perhaps, but this is a pretty good one.
I'm ready.
So this episode was written by Stanley Adams, who also played Cyrano Jones from The Trouble with Tribbles.
Who should have been Harry Mudd.
Yeah. And so he was very, very concerned with overpopulation. As were a lot of people in the 1960s, this was something that was just becoming to be understood as an issue. It was kind of a, you know,
of course,
big issue at the time. So he wrote a script that he wanted to come up with this idea that this planet was severely overpopulated, and kind of just showing
a malfusion,
the problems of overpopulation, which could have been a good episode, but it kind of just is there and then disappears. Kirk gives a very weird speech about, well, we could sterilize you. You could use contraception. I'm imagining that Gideon is what would result from having abortion illegal.
I thought, by the way, that I was very surprised that he mentioned, against sterilization and, abortions and contraceptions and all of, those things were implied as things very casually in a way. Now, I get the idea of a voluntary sterilization versus a eugenics thing. That's, of course,
There's a couple.
But, it seems very commonplace for a I guess for the time, I didn't realize that would be such a casual attitude that early in American history.
I don't. It wasn't.
Which
and
is
so,
interesting.
And
yeah.
So I'm not really sure how that got past NBC.
I guess
the
that's,
only
yeah.
thing that I can imagine is that they were not really paying attention to the show whatsoever at this point. And so they maybe could have gotten away with releasing an episode that was 50 minutes of hardcore sex.
Yeah.
Which probably would have been better than most episodes in the third season.
I would watch this.
Even if it involved Stanley Adams.
Especially if it involved Stanley Adams.
Having sex with a tribble.
That is the trouble with tribbles.
But yeah, it's really strange because the episode has this message. It goes to great pains to set up this planet, which is overpopulated. And then, of course, it's third season Star Trek. They're working on a budget of about $15 an episode. And so they have to they have to show the overpopulation of the planet in as economical a way as possible. And the way that they show is a little goofy, but I guess it's fine. It's very abstract in a way that a lot of third season Star Trek is. And so on that level, I think it's fine. The weird part of it is it's not an episode about that. It's not really an episode about anything. So what happens is you get Kirk giving that speech, which I guess made it past the NBC censors about, well, we could sterilize you, which is weird because of the whole Nazi experiments, which happened only like 25 years ago. Or you could have, you could use contraception, which, the pill was new. Condoms were not really talked about on television in 1969.
Yeah.
So it was very strange. And, he doesn't go so far as to talk about abortion, but it I think it's implied at least. Abortion, of course, wasn't legal nationally at that point. So it's very strange.
The thing is, what I think is hilarious is the response, because he's saying, well, I think life is sacred in all its forms. And it's like, but your life is so shitty. Like,
well,
why do you think that? That's stupid.
Well, that's what I thought was really interesting about it, because I don't know a lot about the history of Roe versus Wade and the fight to make abortion legal in America. So I don't really know if that sort of attitude, which the chancellor of Gideon or whatever the hell he was, was taken from anti-abortion activists in the 60s. I don't even know if there were anti-abortion activists in the 60s. I would assume that there were.
There were definite. That is a general. That's why the term is pro-life. I'm interested. Life begins at conception, so that is a life. So abortion is destroying a life. There is the extreme view of contraception as preventing the possibility of pregnancy, and therefore is anti-natural, is anti-life. Sterilization, an even more obvious, form of that. And so that is a definite viewpoint on the thing. And yet it's one of those which comes in a – we are not 3 billion people inside a tiny room, so – in other words, I'm not sure that attitude is sustainable in Gideon society, while it may be, for the sake of argument, let's avoid overpopulation issues in our own day and age. It is a more sustainable idea to have in this day and age.
Well, I think there's a couple things there. Let's go back to Let That Be Your Last Battlefield for a second, because in that episode, you know, I had much more of a problem with it than you did, in that I felt that the racial message was way too on the nose. In this episode, I feel like it's not on the nose at all, and it's really sort of eliding the point. It's strange to me because what the head of the Gideon says about the sanctity of life and all these kind of things is basically verbatim from, you know, a Catholic stance against abortion. And so in that sense, I think at least nowadays, again, I don't know about 1969, but I think especially now, it sounds to a modern ear like he's an anti-abortion activist. And, you know, if you look at it from the point of view in universe, yeah, that kind of attitude obviously would not make any sense, because the planet is so overpopulated that, you know, everybody has like 2 square feet of space for themselves. Yeah,
it's actually if you talk about in a tragedy of the common sense, getting pregnant is actually damaging to the society as a whole. I mean, I'm also thinking about, you know, the whole, you know, China regulating, you know, the amount of children one can have, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a similar issue in that. Now, again, the morality of that, those kind of laws and the effects of those kind of laws are an entirely different can of worms that I do not want to go into. But they are enforcing a standard of behavior which it has been determined is ultimately beneficial. While it may be slightly damaging to the freedom of the individual, the health of the collective is so at stake the harm to the community outweighs the harm to the individual hundredfold.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at it in terms of Gideon, and of course, you know, we have to take it at face value because the show takes it at face value. But obviously, the idea of a planet populated so tightly that everybody has, you know, 2 square feet of space to themselves is nonsensical. That would never happen. I mean, you know, people would start killing each other. People would start eating each other. I mean, this would not happen. This is impossible. I mean, there would be no way to grow food. There would be no way to sleep. You couldn't. I mean, how would you use the bathroom? You know, people would be shitting on themselves and there would be plagues. I mean, this, you know, it's not realistic, but we just have to take it at face value.
But here's the thing.
That's why I'm bringing this up, because I think what you were saying about China is interesting, and about how that, you know, the one child policy or having these sort of like sterilization policies or what have you, it may be anti-freedom. You know, in Gideon's case, I think having those policies would be pro-freedom this is why I think it's really contextual. They would be pro-freedom because how can you have any freedom whatsoever if you can't even have a life?
Yeah.
And the people of Gideon, as we see, do not have lives.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there are so many things that if you want to pick the logical flaws in this, there are billions. Again, you mentioned how did they have the room to build a replica Enterprise, which is not small. You know,
yeah,
and
I mean the Enterprise is supposed. I mean, you know, I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna show my Trekkie cards here I don't know. I'm just guessing because, you know, I'm sure if you want to write me angry emails, you can. I think it's like 300 meters long or something. I'm not really sure. That's probably not right.
My question is, where did they make it? Like, where did they get the space to? You know, again, you would have thought that they would have, if they had space travel, would have at some point when they're realizing that people are starting to move into the spaceports, like, oh shit, we gotta become a spacefaring species, or we gotta find another planet, or we've got to, you know, start digging underground, or we've got to, like, how did they let this happen without coming up with some kind of solution?
Yeah, of course.
Just seem a very dead and un-ingenuity.
I see what you're saying. I don't know. I mean, we could go down this rabbit hole forever, but I think at the end of the day, you just have to take it at face value because obviously it's nonsensical. You know, and the thing about the Enterprise replica is not only where did they get the room to build it, but why did they build it? Because, you don't need a replica Enterprise to, you know, they seem to have having some sort of experiment with Kirk wandering around the Enterprise, the fake Enterprise. This character who is the leader's daughter is there to do something. I don't even know.
Yeah, I didn't get what. Why? Yeah,
And then, you know, and this is, again, third season Star Trek, I think. You know, it just had, it was just padding. I mean, you know, because if you didn't have that whole fake Enterprise segment of the episode, it would run 15 minutes short.
Which I have to say, when it started, I thought was kind of awesome. Like, the episode ended in a much crappier place than it began, because starting off, Kirk beams down to this planet and he finds himself right back on the Enterprise. He doesn't know what's happening. I mean, there have been episodes where he's been in a parallel universe. Is that what's going on here? Has he become invisible? Has the rest of the ship become invisible? You know, is this an everybody speeding up situation? Like, we've seen so many different, varying degrees of, but very interesting permutations on that theme. And this is, well, to trick him, they built a replica Enterprise. It feels kind of, oh, well, okay, I guess that makes sense.
It's a problem because the episode sets up a mystery that has no satisfactory answer at the end. If you can't come up with a satisfactory explanation for why someone would be doing this and an explanation for how they're going to get out of it, then your mystery is not good. And the episode has so many plot holes. I mean, you know, it was revealed in an earlier episode that they all have like these subdermal transmitters. Just beam Kirk up then. Spock goes down to Gideon at the end of the episode in direct defiance of the Gideons, and his communicator works. Why didn't Kirk just use his communicator? And so it's things like that which really, I mean, and I'm not someone who worries about plot holes so much. I know a lot of people like to nitpick things, but they're obvious. When they're so obvious like that, I think it's a problem, because if Kirk had just whipped his communicator out at the very beginning of the episode, we wouldn't have had an episode, or we would have had a much more interesting one, because I think you could have made this an interesting episode dealing with the effects of overpopulation and maybe sort of the morality of contraception and things like that. The problem there, I guess, is maybe that episode wouldn't have gotten past, you know, the NBC censors. I don't know.
Well,
what do you, I mean, we haven't really touched on the other half of the episode, which is Spock's battles with the Gideon leadership and then also the battles with Starfleet bureaucracy.
I didn't find that to be done interestingly.
Yeah.
We've seen better versions of same.
Yeah, I kind of felt like Spock was really acting out of character there. He was sort of snotty, I think, actually. And, you know, I can't really see Spock arguing with an admiral. It doesn't seem to fit his character.
No, when Spock needs to get around a rule, Spock thinks about it and finds another rule to get him around that rule.
Yeah.
He's very good at finding loopholes and finding things which supersede and figuring out how to disobey orders and citing the regulations which make it seem like he's been actually following orders. Like, that's the thing with Spock. He is so super logical that he can outlogic anybody. And yet again, we've seen several instances in the show where he's done what he's wanted to do but gotten totally away with it because he's managed to shift the situation in a way.
Right.
This episode is not clever enough to figure that out. He just says at the end, well, you know, this is what's right. And that's something Kirk does.
Yeah.
Kirk definitely will, you know, say, you know, yes, these are the rules, but, you know, this is more important than following the rules, you know, the benefit, you know, what I would get from doing this action is right, you know, and what, you know, so he makes a moral judgment. Spock doesn't do that. Spock always, when Spock needs to do something quote unquote immoral or disobedient, he figures out a way of working in the system.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And I think that's a good way to put it. You know, I think the only thing that does feel true to Spock's character, at least, is when he openly defies the Gideons and just beams down. I mean, I think, I think Spock would do that.
Yes.
Especially since he was trying to be logical with them and being very patient with them. And they just weren't having any of it. And of course, they weren't having any of it because there was no possible way that the Gideons were ever going to let another person beam down. And so, at least from that angle, I think it works. But yeah, on the whole, that stuff just feels like, again, it's there to pad the running time of the episode.
Again, I just can't tell. It's one of those episodes where the antagonists, the Gideons, are only antagonists because the episode needs one. And again, if they had been honest with the Federation and said, look, here's our situation, it's awful, you know, the Federation has ways of figuring it out. The Federation has scientists who can terraform planets to be germ-free or can figure out, you know, how do we deal, what kind of injection, you know, can we give them some kind of immunizations that would allow them to live on a planet that does have, or, you know, maybe we, you know, they will figure something out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the failing of the episode at the end of the day.
Yeah. Again, if they had... The episode ended with, you know, a message of, well, look, if we had trusted each other from the beginning, you know, we would have been able to cooperate and help each other out. Again, the Federation can find uses for a gigantic race of immortals. The race of immortals can find use for the Federation's resources. It's a mutual thing. If that had ended with saying, you know, we could have gotten along from the beginning.
The one thing that I will say I like about the episode, just on a little plot detail level and a Star Trek geek level, is this is the first time that we actually hear transporter coordinates. And, you know, they're kind of nonsensical. I mean, I guess we're supposed to interpret them as like a Z, Y, and X axis sort of thing.
That's kind of where, yeah.
And I like the fact that the show, at least this script, was smart enough to have the slightly different transporter coordinates,
yeah,
you know, kind of ding the light bulb in Spock's head to realize that where the guy from the council chambers beamed up to the Enterprise was not the place that they beamed the captain down to. I liked that, and I feel like that was an element of the script that would have worked in an earlier episode of Star Trek, in a better episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, if they had established that earlier and that had been a solution to a mystery.
So I've been a little bit harder on the episode than I maybe intended to be. I think it's entertaining. I you know, like I said before, I think last week, you know, the third season of the Enterprise, third season of Star Trek, I think begins very, very roughly. And a lot of the episodes that in the early part of the season are just tedious. I feel like we've gotten out of that, and I think the episodes are much less tedious than they were. I think they're enjoyable if you just sort of sit back and let it wash over you.
I mean, even though their planet makes no sense, I laughed whenever I saw views of everybody crowded. So
yeah,
out of load, the image, you know, made me smile. So that's I can't fault it. Yeah, you're right. But
I've been in that situation on the L train at 8:30 in the morning.
It squandered the promise that it started with, I guess I would say.
And, yeah.
You know, it's an episode of Star Trek. I guess at the end of the day, it's an episode of Star Trek.
You've been saying that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's what is there to say?
It's average. I give it like a 4.
It's a 5.
Yeah. All right. Well, next week we are going to cover That Which Survives and The Lights of Zatar.
Oh, I can play the Zatar.